Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's part two of our potpourri of health and nutrition stories that didn't find their way into our weekend broadcast, but I thought they were important and worthy of your attention and discussion. This item, yet another study shows that vegetarians are almost twice as likely to suffer from depression as those who consume a conventional balanced diet, according to a new study. There's a place in southwestern England that keeps doing these studies. It's Bristol University. They looked at 10,000 individuals. They found that vegetarians are more likely to develop depression. But, you know, I have to say that this, the way this story is written, it's a little bit skewed. It says that vegetarians were more likely to develop depression due to vitamin and mineral deficiencies that can negatively impact their mental health. Okay. I'll comment on that in a minute. The 350 committed vegetarians in the study had a higher average depression score when compared to the meat eaters, according to the study, which was published in the Journal of Affective Disorders. That's with an A, not an affective disorder like EFF, it's AFF, and an F like a disorder of the affect would be depression. You're depressed, is your affect is sad. Word of the day. Okay, so the vegetarian's diet tended to feature lower vitamin B12 consumption as well as greater intake of nuts that contained omega-6 fatty acids, which have been linked with an increased risk of mental health problems. That, you know, I got to say, that is not good reporting, because I know of no study that suggests that more omega-6 fatty acids have been linked with an increased risk of mental health problems. Well, they are potentially pro-inflammatory, but mostly that can come from a diet that is high in poor quality vegetable oils. Okay, that might be pro-inflammatory, but I don't think there's any study that nuts make you nuts. No matter their omega-6 fatty acid content. Vegetarians have a lower B12 consumption. This, by the way, this is CBS local news, so, you know, the 12-and-a-half-year-old who wrote this article may not be aware of salient facts about nutrition. They've also found that slightly more than 50% of vegans and 7% of vegetarians have a vitamin B12 deficiency. Well, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. If you're determined to be a vegan, at least you should take a multivitamin and perhaps some iron to offset potential deficiencies. So it's not inevitable. So they also cite other potential factors include high blood levels of phytoestrogens. Well, gee, do phytoestrogens make you more estrogenic, make you more PMS-y? You know, is that, you know, part of the problem? Do men who are vegetarians, are they more female or feminine or, you know, in the pejorative sense, they lack adequate testosterone? Well, that's, I think, something that needs to be worked out. There may be a relationship between lack of cholesterol and low levels of sex hormones, because cholesterol is a building block for androgens like testosterone. Another potential contributing factor is that lower intakes of seafood are thought to be associated with greater risk of depressive symptoms. That I agree with. Also, they cite iron deficiencies. Well, iron deficiency, really common in young gals who menstruate, but also tend to be a little bit more towards the vegan or vegetarian side. You know, they're idealistic young women, and they have an affinity for animals, and they're going to go vegan or vegetarian sometimes, and they're shortchanging themselves. And also, very high levels of exercise can sometimes deplete your iron. So what I would also comment on, and they finally get to this at the bottom of this article, but the researchers did not rule out the possibility that the vegetarians' decisions to adopt their diet could have been a symptom of depression from the start. Okay, so correlation is not necessarily causation. And to properly do this study, you'd have to take a bunch of folks and sequester them, and inspect every meal, make sure that they're really adhering to either a vegan diet or an omnivore diet, and follow them prospectively, randomize them, not just because merely by the fact that you've opted for a vegetarian diet. Well, I don't know, maybe people who are vegetarian, not necessarily more depressed, but maybe they're a little more sensitive souls. You know, they see animal cruelty and they react to it. And maybe that is, you know, associated with a risk of mood disorders. You know, a harsher way of saying it is you got to be crazy to become a vegetarian. But I think that's a little bit exaggerated, having been a vegetarian myself, a vegan vegetarian for many years when I was in my 20s and early 30s. You know, perhaps people are a little bit more extreme, perhaps a little more obsessive when they pay that much attention to diet. But you could say the same thing about people who eat a lot of meat on a paleo diet. They're obsessive in a different way. They're obsessive about carbs, and they're obsessive about junk food and keeping grains and dairy out of their diet. So the question is it correlation or is it causation? And the answer remains elusive. But this actually is yet another study that strengthens the literature that shows an association between vegetarianism and mood disorders. And I've commented on that in a recent story, which you can find at drhoffman.com. All right, you can love this, folks, because there's a company out there, and it's on the stock exchange, so you know, hurry and call your broker. A company called, I'm just kidding, because I tell you, you just do not want to bet on medical breakthroughs, because they tend to do really well, or they can crash and burn. So this is a company that specializes in the study of the microbiome and how to harness the microbiome to enhance health. And one of these days, we'll see if we can get a representative from that company to talk to us. The company's called OptiBiotics. Maybe we'll do a podcast with them. OptiBiotics. As the name suggests, they're looking for ways to optimize health via probiotics. And they've cornered the market on a species or a strain of the bacterial species Lactobacillus plantarum called LPLDL, trademark. And how they came up with this is that they looked at 4,000 candidate bugs or probiotic bacteria, and they were looking for something that could basically eat up cholesterol. Now, it doesn't literally eat up cholesterol, but it helps to rapidly metabolize cholesterol. I recently did a podcast and a series of articles on gallbladder disease, and it turns out that the microbiome has an impact on the risk of gallstones, which are made out of cholesterol. When too much cholesterol accumulates in the gallbladder, that's bad because stones form, and the type of bacteria you have in your gut can influence the circulation of bile salts, which help to sweep away and or neutralize high cholesterol. So after screening 4,000 different probiotic species, they found one that was outstanding in its capability to hydrolyze bile salts. And it therefore has an impact on cholesterol and liver function, and probably reduces the risk for gallstones, because gallstones are largely cholesterol. And they did a study, a randomized controlled human study, and they found that this stuff lowered cholesterol. You ready for this? Are you sitting down? It lowered total cholesterol by up to 36.7%. Now, I emphasize up to, you know, what that means is asterisk, results may vary. You know, this may not happen for you, but in this experimental setup, the addition of this probiotic in humans in a randomized controlled trial considerably lowered cholesterol. It lowered LDL cholesterol by up to 14%. It increased the good cholesterol by 6.5%. And oh, by the way, it lowered systolic blood pressure by 5%. And I'm not sure why, but it had a beneficial effect on blood pressure because we know that the microbiome has an impact on overall metabolism. And there's a cardiometabolic connection to the bugs in your gut related to your risk of obesity and insulin resistance, and maybe that's the link to blood pressure control. So let's keep an eye on these products that are being rolled out this fall. One product is called Cholbiome, said to reduce cholesterol and blood pressure. The other one's called Cardiobiome, which reduces cardiovascular risk factors, improves your cholesterol profile, and so on. Again, you know, it's that's the pitch. Let's see if the product delivers on its promise. But interesting nonetheless. And what can probiotics not do? It's amazing. They can affect mood. They can affect hormone levels. They can affect weight. They can affect, as this demonstrates, cholesterol. They have an impact on the immune system, and on and on and on it goes. And, you know, for example, one of our sponsors makes a probiotic that makes glutathione, which is a premier antioxidant detoxifying component of the body's detoxification pathways. So probiotics really can be very, very important adjunct to your overall health program. All right. As you age, it actually becomes more and more difficult for you to get adequate protein for several reasons. One is that your taste buds may change. And we, you know, by virtue of disease or by virtue of chemotherapy or by virtue of taking antibiotics or the aging process itself, your taste buds change, and you may end up preferring sweet, soft food. Food that is delectable, like ice cream and pie, but is relatively bereft of valuable protein. That's number one. Number two, your appetite may shrink as you get older, and your satiety is reached much more easily. And part of that's due to a decline in your production of digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid in your stomach. And actually, many older individuals, we deliberately block their hydrochloric acid. They're on acid-blocking medication. And so protein is limited. Now, it used to be thought that as you get older, you don't need as much protein because, after all, you know, you shrink down, you're smaller. And so, you know, obviously, you know, you look at an NFL lineman as our football season cranks up, and those guys consume massive amounts of protein to support their musculature. But, you know, if you're a frail little old lady, you don't need much protein. So went the thinking until recently. What they've discovered is that the recommended dietary allowance for protein, which is 0.8 grams per kilogram per day. Okay, so what's a kilogram? Let's say the average woman may weigh 50, 60 kilograms. So 0.8, so the 0.8 times 6, that's like 50 grams. You only need about 50 grams of protein per day, according to that scheme. But it turns out that actually, as you age, you may need more protein. More protein even than a younger person. And so the dilemma is it's harder and harder to eat that protein. People also get a little lazy. You know, maybe they live alone. You know, it's harder to cook for one. you know, shopping and so on and so on and so on. And then there's a lot of older people who are relatively impoverished. They can't afford adequate protein. So in this article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition of last month, the headline is Nutrition in the Elderly, a Recommendation for More and Evenly Distributed Protein. So they say, critically, requirements for dietary protein in older persons appear to be greater than those in younger persons. Whoa, that's turning the whole paradigm on its head. It has also been shown that protein consumption at meals throughout the day can influence muscle mass. Okay, what they're saying here is don't just have a little fruit for breakfast and then have, I don't know, a baked potato for lunch. And then maybe have like, okay, you know, you're saving it for later, have like a little lamb chop for dinner. You know, not too much because these days you can't, you know, eat that much. No, have some little, have some of your protein at breakfast, have some of your protein at lunch, and have some of your protein at dinner. Distribute it through the day. That, according to a study in this issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, it was found that older, that was on the average 74-year-old men and women, do better with evenly distributed protein intakes. They had higher whole body lean mass and what's also called appendicular lean mass. That means in their legs and in their arms. So it wasn't even just, it was, they needed more, but they also needed evenly distributed protein intake across meals, independent of total quantity of proteins. That was associated with higher muscle strength score in both men and women. And in men, but not women, there was a greater mobility score when you had the protein distributed across several meals. So that's kind of interesting. And they also have studies which show that it's okay to use supplemental protein. Now, why would they say you don't need as much protein when you get older, or that maybe you should be cautious about too much protein when you get older? The thought was that, oh, you know, as you get older, your kidney function deteriorates, and all that protein is going to mess up your kidney function, so you don't want to burden your kidneys. Your kidneys do the job of excreting protein waste products, so you want to skimp on your protein as you get older. No, it turns out that that's not a big factor, and we actually want to boost the protein. Branched chain amino acids, things like hydrolyzed whey protein, an amino acid that's particularly important for maintaining muscle mass in the elderly is leucine. So look for formulas that are high in the amino acid leucine, because leucine seems to forestall muscle loss. And the key word here is sarcopenia, which is a precursor of frailty. They say it's imminently amenable to treatment through physical activity and higher and more evenly distributed dietary protein intake. And, oh, by the way, another component of that might be pairing the protein with adequate vitamin D, because that may also stave off the decline. And finally, here's an item that kind of attests to the benefits of herbal medicine. You know, recently there was a fascinating, you know, and I love anthropology because I'm an anthropology major in college, and they came up with a new way of detecting what is on the tooth surfaces of fossilized remains of Neanderthals so that they can determine what they ate. And one of the things that they found was that they show residues of penicillin mold and residues of what's called salicylic acid. Now, salicylic acid, better known as aspirin, that's acetyl salicylic acid, it turns out that this is a traditional remedy used for centuries and perhaps thousands of years. And then a guy named Hoffman, Joseph Hoffman, who worked for a company called Bayer. Have you heard of that company? His first patent medication was aspirin around the 1880s in Germany. And so what they did is they basically took a constituent of bark, white oak bark, which is salicylic acid, and they made it into a patent medication. And so now Neanderthals, who live 30, 40, 50,000 years ago or more, there is evidence that they were herb gatherers and that they wild crafted herbs, and that they had a pretty extensive repertoire of finding stuff in their environment that could help aid with pain, that could help deal with wounds and infections. And it's fascinating when you can read about it in a novel called Clan of the Cave Bears. It's a 1980s novel, but it's fascinating, where Gene Aul, who wrote that, envisioned a fairly complex culture of wildcrafting among Neanderthals, that they had medicine women. It was primarily the job of the women to gather the plants. And this is something that is borne out in the latest discovery, because we got this terrible infection. It's a brain-eating parasite. You've heard of people who bathe in lakes in the south, and it's a parasite. It's an amoeba that somehow gets into the brain. And once it gets in the brain, you're done. You're done. There's nothing that will cure it. There is a medication called miltefosine, which has some activity against the brain-eating amoeba, which is called Negleri fowleri. While it's a rare infection, there really isn't an answer for it. Well, researchers at the Anschutz Medical Campus of Colorado University, along with folks at University of California, San Diego, studied naturally occurring compounds in the creosote bush, which is commonly found in the American Southwest and part of the repertoire of the Native Americans. In Native cultures, the plants traditionally used to treat a wide range of medical problems, including intestinal parasites. Well, Negleri is a parasite. And there is an ingredient in creosote bush, let's see if I get the pronunciation. It's a tough one. Nordihydroguaiuretic acid, or NDGA. And they found that NDGA is effective at fighting Negleri, but it's also effective against fighting something else that's pretty tough to beat, which is Giardia. Just Giardia infections are certainly much more common than Negleri, which is very rare. I mean, it kills maybe a handful of people every year, but there's thousands and thousands of people who come up with Giardia infections from polluted water. I find sometimes Giardia is hard to treat, but using this extract of the creosote bush, they say could provide a more effective and less expensive treatment option. And this provides further encouragement to scientists looking to native cultures for helpful insights. That's why we gotta do a little anthropology, go into the bush, talk to the natives, see what they use for their ailments, do a little scientific study on the components of that, and we may come up with miracle drugs for things like malaria, for example. Well, malaria, currently a drug in use, is actually a traditional remedy. It's Artemisia. Artemisia is an herb, part of the repertoire of traditional Chinese medicine, now a mainstay of treatment against malaria, one of the more effective drugs, in fact, against malaria, originally from the herbal armamentarium. So, very cool study. And that's all we have for today. So, thanks for joining us. And I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.